You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I, of course, am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the early morning hours of the 29th of June, 2025. One of the things I do here, I've been doing this for many, many years, is to talk about figures that have been relegated to obscurity unjustly. Especially many right-wing royalist Orthodox figures from Russia who've not been translated, who deserve more attention than they get. And we're going to do that again today. And we're going to talk about the life and work of Mikhail Magnitsky, who died in 1844. This is connected to some of the things, if you recall, I did on Golitsyn and the Bible Society. We're talking a lot about the same period of time, mostly under the rule of Alexander I in Russia. This is a man who did not start off as a royalist or a right-winger in general, but he became that. And let me start off with a direct quote from him. He didn't write a lot. But this is from his third philosophical fragment. Only in our time, well-intentioned people have imagined that between good and evil, between error and truth, between impiety and faith, it's possible to find some mean and adhere to it. This opinion has shaken all other principles, all rules, all positive laws. From it, everything has become true and everything falls. When there's a need for religion, they stand up for it. As soon as a cry of its enemies increases, they retreat from it, as if they're ashamed of it. This shakes the good, but the evil, seeing their strength, are assured of the success of their activity and extend their insolence further. Impiety has its own religion. Reunion with the light-bearer, cold as its pride and fanatical. Now, in Russia, I think the name of Mikhail Magnitsky is somewhat better known. And he's associated mostly, as most of the literature has mentioned already, with the labels that his enemies have attached to him. The destroyer of university life is one. An extreme reactionary, this kind of nonsense. But I would say for the most part, he's ignored. But the truth is, that regardless of how healthy or unhealthy society is, Russia, especially compared to ours, was an extremely healthy society, especially in its peasant base, but it had to be maintained. It doesn't just happen. Its enemies were everywhere. And one of those maintainers was Magnitsky. This man was of extraordinary will and energy, very high intelligence, an excellent education. He spoke all European languages and was a diplomat, among many other things. And for some time, he was the closest friend of Mikhail Speransky, who was the tutor and then later advisor of Tsar Alexander I. This man was anything but average. He stood out. And for a long time, he was just, you attached a label to him. He was an ignorant reactionary, and that was just the end of it. And we'll get to exactly why they like throwing these labels around with him here in a minute. He comes from a line of mathematicians. The Magnitsky surname was bestowed upon, I think it was his grandfather, by Peter I. Tilyashin was the family's original name. But the elder Magnitsky was a mathematician. Also, a deep supporter of orthodoxy, and he had extraordinary theological knowledge. Actually, it was his great-grandfather, but his great-grandson, Mikhail, born at a rough time in Russian history, April of 1778. His father, Leonti, began his service under the only really good part of the 18th century, the Empress Elizabeth. He was a sergeant of the guard there. But he maintained his position and other positions under Catherine II, and he was a privy councillor. The family was never wealthy, even at their best. Longinov, who was one of the secretaries of Empress Elizabeth, that whole family, they lived almost on alms in Moscow until his son got him a place, a rank, a ribbon, pension, a salary. His father married some French woman from a fashion shop, having nothing but his salary, which he wasn't used to, still supported his whole family in luxury. The phrase was living like Lucullus, a reference to the Roman general working under Sulla. His campaigns brought him tremendous wealth. But Mikhail was well-educated. He went to a noble boarding school and Moscow University and was always at the top of the class, as we would say. And he stood out in that regard. And it wasn't just his artistry and his ability, but he was very charming. He was extremely witty, and he had a gift with words. He was excellent on his feet, and something like that is going to come in handy. And it's something that made his enemies wince quite a bit, because that's the last thing that they want to deal with. Court politics, you know, even at its fringes, was extremely important. It doesn't matter what kind of society, what system you have, bureaucratic politics is always going to be a problem. He knew how to parody his opponents. He knew how to play the dozens, as the blacks would say. He was considered very good looking, did not have a beard. He was also an excellent poet. He was a polymath in most senses of the word, and languages especially came very easy to him. Of course, this is the last sort of person you want to turn against liberalism. He was transferred. He was with the Peter Brzezinski regiment, became a captain there, but he was transferred to the College of Foreign Affairs in 1798 and was sent to the transfer of the embassy in Vienna, where he met and he actually worked with Alexander Suvorov. And he learned quite a bit from him. A lot of what Magnitsky is going to become comes from the people who he had associations with. Now, in 1802, he received a post that's going to change everything. He was appointed secretary of the embassy in Paris. This is right after the revolution. In fact, there are some who say that Napoleon, and this is, from what I could see, a perfectly believable story, he said something witty to him, and he said, you know, this young man is going to go far in his fatherland and for his fatherland. His reputation suggests that that's definitely a possibility. He got back after that. He was the head of the expedition department of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Now remember, Mikhail Speransky knew Napoleon, but he was also a Freemason. And in 1810, Speransky brought him into the Polar Star Masonic Lodge. The good news is that he will soon reject the lodge. Not only that, they'll urge the czars to take action against them. Something that his former mentor, when they met again many years later, condemned him for. Speransky died in 1839. One of the things he was known for, and this is a few years earlier, he was sent by Alexander I as a secret auditor. Remember, the governorships in the various Russian regions were appointed. But the czars were very good about making sure that governors were working properly. In the first place he was sent was Pskov. In fact, after Magnitsky was sent there, that governor was removed for taking bribes. It's something only monarchs can do because they're above all of that kind of thing. They're above these people with money. So sending a secret mission and then getting rid of these people, regardless of how much money they had or didn't have, this is something very specific to a monarchy. After that, he went to Vilnius. And there he was sent to look for any French agents. Including Napoleon was a problem. Now, initially he came to no firm conclusion. But later on he did say that he discovered a nest of future rebellion and conspiracy in favor of the revolutionary French, especially at the university there. And that's extremely important. 1808, he started to develop himself as a political thinker, and he wrote to Alexander I. He said, "It is not the impudent public talkers who shake governments. They are shaken by the general opinion and the people who govern them." Now, there's a lot in those words. What he's saying is that there were attempts that public opinion was something manipulated by others. And that's what shakes governments. The great virtue, and the reason we're talking about him tonight, is Magnitsky was one of the earliest to realize this revolutionary conspiracy that was developing in most European capitals, that had already exploded in the French Revolution, and it had cells everywhere. He was one of the first to bring it to light because he was part of the embassy staff, high ranking in the embassy staff too, in Paris right after the revolution. He saw its results firsthand. He was one of the first to use the term Illuminati, or one of the very early uses of it. That's not a term I use. But some of his best political thought was in letters that he wrote. And this letter he wrote to Tsar Nicholas I much later. And he kind of lays this out. It's very important. It says, "The Illuminati, having existed for so long, had to grow stronger all the time, having formed in its sense that menacing public opinion which is directed according to its whim. Literature, the sciences, the arts already turned to its goal with the most hellish cunning. For from the initial books of childhood to the courses in higher sciences, classical Illuminism is so skillfully grafted that on one hand, only the most experienced and sophisticated observation is noticeable, and on the other, it is understandable and what's necessary for the Illuminati to the simplest mind." And he wrote that in 1831. Now, so that's exactly what we mentioned in terms of manipulating public opinion. Most of the time when you talk about the public, you're talking about the nobility in a few cities. So it's hardly, you know, public opinion in any normal sense. But the term Illuminati, of course, it's a reference to Lucifer. It's often scorned and made fun of by normies. I never use it. But he is using it, again, as a very early stage of this, and that's where his virtue is to be found. Understand at this early date, he's using this term to refer very broadly to all revolutionary activity, all of their cells acting in secret throughout the world, making war on the church and the crown without fail. The concept derives from the fact that they are the enlightened ones. These men alone have understood the purpose of history and human nature, and therefore have the right to impose their will on that society around them through violence. Illuminism is inherently revolutionary. Of course, it's connected with, to some extent, Kabbalah and certainly alchemy. And they use this terminology all the time to take the leaden, you know, in reference to lead or Saturn, the leaden Christian peasant and turn him into the golden image of the revolution, the new man that would lead the world to peace and paradise on earth. He writes this, and again, this was much later. "There's another branch, the Illuminati, which must be seen for the subsequent disclosure of its relations to Russia. It is an English spiritual Illuminati, which constituted a vast conspiracy of various more or less absurd schisms of the Anglican Church, and especially the Methodists, who at the beginning of their establishment called themselves Illuminati. The connection of this society with the Illuminati in general is proved by two circumstances. Number one, the union of it with the Masons, the highest degrees, and number two, the uniformity under various forms of their mutual aim and expectations. The Illuminati are enemies of all positive Christian confessions, Methodists as well. The Illuminati expect and demand a worldwide transformation in which the bliss of humanity will begin. And so do the Methodists, according to an ancient schism, the concept of the millennium. They expect that some savior will come and all the churches will be destroyed. The true one alone will remain from the chosen ones. That's when the thousand-year kingdom of God on earth will begin. This is what he calls the spiritual Illuminati. Having become extremely strong in England, its overseas possession, as well as in America, preparing the field for action of the political Illuminati, shaking the Reformed churches and smoothing out their so-called divisions. Now assisting the rebellions of England, they have led an open attack in Parliament on the Anglican Church. Just as in France, the Illuminati are attacking the Catholic Church under the name of the Jesuits and the Congregation. Now, while it's true that these words were written in the future, in the 1830s, but the source of these words were developing in his earlier career, the period we're talking about here. He was an excellent reformer. He got a lot of people in trouble, and he was sent to various places I've already mentioned. A lot of people were removed for bribe-taking or immorality. So he realized that the state has to be as pure as humanly possible if it was to be effective in making war on these new enlightened ones. I think the best way to summarize his view on this Illuminati might be summarized in this part of his letter to Nicholas I, February 3rd, 1831. And I like this part. The Society of the Illuminati, in fact, more or less embraces the whole of Europe. It now consists of invisible chiefs, under whom stand a few of the most important adepts, and under these latter, all the other degrees from the Lesser Illuminati to the Hierophant. Here also the secret societies join it, under their various names and types, having the Illuminati as their head. This constitutes the part of the conspirators, so to speak, the governing part, and the governed, or the Illuminati people, consists of these four. Number one. All impious and depraved people anywhere who, seeing no purpose in their existence, desire changes and upheavals just in order to dispel some dark feelings. Number two, all people led astray by half enlightenment from the path of religion and wishing to freely indulge their passions. Number three, from all the schisms of various Christian confessions, they too are nothing other than rebels against their own churches. And number four, for all of those who are deceived under the guise of various mystical teachings. For they also do not tolerate spiritual power, and consequently, they also endure civil power out of the fear of benefit and dream of the revolutions of the social order, only under other forms, thus unknowingly assisting the same Illuminati, for they want to shake the existing order by shaking those moral positive laws, without which no Christian society could stand firm. This is why the most honest and good-natured people can be blind and unfortunate tools of the Illuminati. He was aware, firsthand really, that all revolutions lead to civil war. There's no doubt. Revolutions in the sense that we normally use the term. This is because the war against the moral law unleashes the passions. It doesn't unleash reason. There are no restraints on the ego and the will of those that are seeking power. A war like that benefits those who have the fewest moral qualms. And yet, these are the same people that, if they win, come to rule society. He goes on to mention the wars that occurred during and after the French Revolution, the attempts on Napoleon's life, as well as the murder of the Duke of Berry. In more detail, this all comes from this universal hatred. Now I'm quoting him here. Universal hatred revealing itself in rebellions and murders and an ardent desire for destruction. What doctrine did that monster of our time, Louis Louvel, profess, who struck the hope of France in the person of the Duke of Berry? that being whose whole soul was fused from one crime, which fell asleep after committing the crime, atheism. What doctrine did Louvel and his disciples profess? Deism. That is a painted atheism. That is what he believed in. Now, by talking about the Duke of Berry, he's referring to Charles Ferdinand, who was an officer in the Army of the Condé and other counter-revolutionary formations during the post-revolutionary civil wars. In 1820, the Duke of Berry was stabbed and mortally wounded by Louvel. He was leaving an opera house at Paris with his wife. He died the next day. Louvel was a saddle maker. He was a Bonapartist, opposed to the monarchy in general. Point being, once that Pandora's box of the passions is open politically, closing it again is almost impossible. And Russia was one of the last states of consequence that was at war with its contents. So his work in local government was extremely important. So he was trying to rectify problem wherever he was sent, inspecting local government. One of the things he began advocating was a real aristocracy. He proposed to grant special privileges to this, the best of the best, to eliminate any hostility between the bureaucracy and the military. Local government especially, he saw in the Zemstva police officers and district judges, he saw them as deeply corrupt bribe takers, but also to provide them with sufficient salaries so they don't need bribes. He also was worried about the ethnic composition of some of these people. He said he needed to promote figures of Russian origin to the top posts in the state rather than Ukrainians or Poles or Germans, as has been the case so often, something that Peter the Great began. And clearly this pleased the emperor. I'm sure he made plenty of enemies doing this. But in 1810, Alexander brought him closer to himself, and he became Secretary of State for the Department of Laws in the State Council, with a high rank. And the Petrine reforms, he was an actual state counselor. He was in charge of all military affairs at the highest levels and drew up instructions for the commanders of the Russian armies. In 1811, the emperor gave him the order to form the structure of the Ministry of Military and Police. And so, together with the Minister of War, Michael Bogdanovich, who's known as Prince Michael Andreas Barclay-de-Tolly, headed the commission for drawing up regulations for all units, the Ministry of War, just prior to the invasion of Napoleon. On March 17, 1812, Magnitsky was suddenly declared a state criminal and sent to exile. The reason for this was the fall of Speransky. He was accused of his intent to overthrow the existing order and criminal relations with the French government. He was exiled to Novgorod. Magnitsky was sent to Vologda. He had to endure a lot in exile. For some reason, exile often wasn't that big of a deal. But it was like he was labeled. It got very bad. Because of this stigma that was you know, placed on him. There's one story where the obstetrician refused to come to his pregnant wife. Now, I don't know the connection there. In the shops, they sold him goods at 500% markup, much higher than usual. They had to sell everything they had. After the French captured Moscow, he thought that the merchants from the Vologda meat stalls were going to kill him. In his testimony to Alexander I, he said, "For several months, every night, with my sick pregnant wife and young son, I expected an attack by the drunken mob at any moment." Later on, he said his wife, from the harsh climate, lost her health, and our daughter died as a result of being ignored by these people. There was also, though, a connection to the lodges. Even Speransky, who was the first to bring him in to the Polar Star, thought they had become too powerful. Alexander I was very capricious. It was just a few years later, as suddenly as he got rid of them, he forgave them. That That arbitrariness did the state nothing but harm. The state was a difficult thing to predict. And he went back to his old job. In 1816, he was appointed to the post of Voronezh vice governor. So he went from being a secret auditor and uncovering crimes and corruption in the governorships in Russia to actually being one. But he did the same kind of thing. In a very short time, he uncovered significant abuses amongst the noble elites. In fact, the nobility in where he was, he said they had been they robbed the place blind. Over ₹1 million. He also noticed, and this was not the first time that this was dealt with, that there was a backlog of cases, both not only court cases, but petitions to the governor's office that had just accumulated. And he demanded an audit of the police and the district bureaucracy. Then later, he was appointed to the post of civil governor in Simbirsk. And he did the same kind of thing there. He was a protector of the peasants from the powerful. Turgenev, the novelist, actually visited his estates in 1818, and he said, "Magnitsky is becoming legendary here with his political management. Throughout the province, there are incessant investigations against nobles who abuse their power. I am beginning to respect him as a defender of the peasants, although I see in his actions a carelessness, inexperience, and perhaps a desire to curry favor." Well, that's kind of unfair. He certainly was experienced. And of course he wants to curry favor. That's, you know, that really doesn't mean anything. But he still had a solid relationship with Speransky, who was one of the most powerful men of this era. Speransky said that Magnitsky behaved like a knight, the eradicator of all abuses. But something else happened here. Something that's going to change his life forever. Starting in 1819, Alexander proposed that he become what amounted to an auditor of the Ministry of Spiritual Affairs and Public Education. Became a member of the main board of schools. And that's something that made every revolutionary in the country wince. Specifically, Kazan University. In February, that same year, 1819, he was instructed to conduct an inspection of the activities of Kazan University, which had been established just in 1805. It was seen as just a nest of revolution. You had plenty of conservatives who just said these things need to be shut down. Now, they weren't closed, but they were reorganized. These absolutely were not educational institutions, but political ones, opposed to the monarchy. And that made him far more enemies than anything else he's ever done. And he was correct. He wasn't aware of how bad the situation was. We know how bad the situation was. But the Minister of Spiritual Affairs and Public Education was the man who we've dealt with before. The leftist mason, the revolutionary Alexander Golitsyn. He did say, though, that Kazan University had been neglected. And he was the one who sent Magnitsky in to conduct an inspection. This is apparently what he was known for. What happened after that is what angered his enemies. This is where he was an obscurantist. He was a reactionary because he dared step onto the hallowed grounds of the academic establishment, which apparently somehow attracts only revolutionaries. He saw what was coming before most other people. This is 1819. He saw a well-financed conspiracy in the lodges and other cells in Russia with money coming from abroad. Now, the word conspiracy, we all know how that's used. But properly, it's refers to the concerted action of a revolutionary political group functioning in secret using symbols rather than discursive prose, seeking primarily the destruction of the monarchy and the church to liberate the passions of these new would-be rulers, leading ultimately to oligarchy, of course, never democracy or anything good. This is what he was referring to by the Illuminati, the self-chosen men who believe they have the key to man's happiness and thus have the right to violently force society into it. And he wrote the following, not at the time, but it was a little bit later. All the lodges of Paris, according to the voice of Mirabeau, were assembled at the temple of God, against whom they had risen up. And this temple was called the Jacobin Club. Since then, all the conspirators of various names against God and kings, masons of various degrees, Rosicrucians, Knights of the Sun, disciples of Voltaire and Rousseau, Templars, followers of Swedenborg, St. Martin and Weishaupt, have united under the name of Jacobin. Unanimously and openly took up all the horrors of the revolution. The Grand Orient of Paris sent to all European lodges a manifesto, signed by the Duke of Orleans, in which Masons of all countries were invited to unite, to support the revolution, and spread it everywhere by all possible means. In all the societies of the French Illuminati, in imitation of Weishaupt, there were black and red, they would call, bloody lists. The first contained the names of suspected members, strangely enough, and the second, those condemned to death for treason or abandonment of the order. So all of these groups united the Illuminati before the opening of the French Revolution. Lafayette, a disciple of them, was already a member of the Illuminati. But on the day of the general rebellion, July 14, 1789, the general outcry of liberty and equality, the conspirators left their lodge, stirred in Paris with axes, guns, and pikes, and broke into the Bastille. The couriers who carried this news to the provinces bring back the news that all towns and villages have risen in rebellion. The general cry, equality and liberty. So this had nothing to do with anyone rising up. These were the elite of society, a fragment of the elite of society, who thought they should have more power than they currently do, who saw the moral strictures of Catholicism and Orthodoxy as unnecessarily constricting in every way, and rose up against the monarchy. But it's talking like this, of course, abandoning Masonry, is the reason why the left hates them and still does. So he goes to Kazan University, and the professors there did everything they could. And of course, later on, they wrote about him, saying he was ignorant of the peculiarities of university life here, but they didn't care about that. Academics, this was not the voice of the people, but a highly secretive cult that was spreading throughout Europe and responsible for the French Revolution. And universities had become a tool for their purposes. For those of you who've been following what Pete and I are doing with the Solzhenitsyn book, 200 Years Together, we show in tremendous detail, a bit after this, a period of time, the Jews had, even in fairly small numbers, had taken over the universities in Western Russia, purged them of any, you know, right-wing professors of any kind. Or they ran it like they do today. That even a small number of Jews at any university would automatically turn them into a hotbed of rebellion. So they complained and complained. His criticism of Kazan University was caused by politics, not academic motives, and certainly not by any flagrant abuse, since the university was obviously above the suspicion, a sanctuary of freedom and progress. And they still think that today. They made up stories that Magnitsky expelled the best professors from the university. People still say that when they, you know, people who specialize in this area. They were formulated in the 1860s. However, looking at the audit materials, it's a very different story. While the universities were just starting to become centers of revolution, and their acceptance of Jews, you know, in this very early date, made them even more so, they were no longer centers of education. But he should have gone further than he did. But again, his power was limited. But it wasn't ideological. His report on Kazan University shows how the left ran, like they run all universities, as their own private fiefdom. Abuses and actual crimes. The theft of significant sums from the university budget. Huge expenses for education at a time with minimal return. False reporting. Falsification of exams. Dubious levels of qualification for a significant part of the professors. And of course, the very poor moral level. The physical crumbling of academic buildings. Students were living in unsanitary conditions and so much more. Because the left was taking this money for themselves. The left considered then and now the universities as their own private property and hated any kind of oversight against them, above them. What Magnitsky said about this university, and I say this is pretty, even though it was fairly new, I think in many Russian universities, especially Western Russian universities, he was objective. Now, there were big names there. Nikolai Lobachevsky was there, the famous astronomer. Ivan Shimonov, who was a part of the polar expedition. Mikhail Lazarev. Now, this is still an early period of time where Jews were just starting to enter the universities and becoming professors. It's very early, but Magnitsky was able to see it at this early date. Now, they take out this quote from him. And of course, they take it out of context and they abuse it. And the quote is, "In absolute justice, and with all the strictness of law, the university is subject to destruction in the form of its public destruction." Now, when you take that out of context, it seems awful. But these people are not honest. But what he advocated was not for the abolition of the place. He wanted to see a boarding school for the noble youth. Part of it because it's in Kazan, so you have Tartars there. He wanted a Tartar school there. He wanted this money to be used properly, a medical institute, hospitals. He also wanted a veterinary department, which makes a lot of sense. But it's going to be one or the other. The university was either going to be a hotbed of revolution or a source of tradition and religion. There was no third option because there's no vacuum in politics, even at this early date. Now, calling someone a reactionary, it's a very odd charge. The Marxists made this popular. I guess it all depends on what you're reacting to. Now, they knew what his views were. They knew that he abandoned the Freemasons. Now, the left rarely reveals his total agenda. I mean, the whole point of the degrees is taking the man and reshaping his mind slowly to shed its previous thoughts and to cleanse it, bringing it to accept the ideology of the new man, slowly but surely revealing more and more to him. And of course, they were going to do that to the society at large. They couldn't do that so long as a strong monarchy and church existed in Russia. But in Orthodox Russia, in the first half of the 19th century, he was outraged that there was no real references to Christian morality and knowledge of Christian themes were wanting among students, discipline and everything else. Deism had become all the rage there. Now, he used the word philosophy, which is the same in Russian and in English. He's not using it in the same way we do. Sometimes the left deliberately uses that against him. Now, when he says philosophy, he means the modern Enlightenment, rationalist, and materialist point of view, not philosophy as such. He said, "Without a doubt, all governments should pay special attention to the general system of their educational enlightenment, which, having thrown off the modest veil of philosophy, rationalism, already stands in the middle of Europe with a raised dagger." And we know today that the situation was far worse than he had realized. Here's what he said. all the Masons have gone from their dens to the quarters, to the town halls, the revolutionary committees, and have formed what they call a popular assembly. Murderers and robbers were released from prison, while the outposts have been burned, castles are ablaze, corpses hang from lampposts, heads are carried about on pikes. The king is besieged in the palace, his bodyguards are cut down, the queen barely escapes. The heir of Henry IV and Louis XIV is taken prisoner by the Illuminati in the middle of his capital. Of course, he's talking about the French Revolution here. He knows exactly what he means. This isn't about freedom of thought. Freedom of thought implies a vacuum. There is no such thing. It's one or the other. And this is exactly what's being planned for Russia. And the universities would play, as they always have, a key role. He certainly was knowledgeable and competent enough to make judgments about the specific aspects of university life there. His study lasted 2 weeks, and his report ultimately was 4 volumes long. So then in 1819, he was then appointed the trustee, and the left was just going crazy at this point, of the Kazan Educational District, and was given orders to alter how this university was run. You figure in Orthodox Russia in 1819, having to introduce the teaching of theology and Christian doctrine seems strange. Dismissing some professors from their positions. I mean, whatever he did, it wasn't enough. And given his reputation, with all the way he's purged these governorships, and you know, this is what he does. Every corrupt person trembles when he shows up. The university was screaming about its autonomy, which is utter nonsense. Autonomy means control by the revolutionaries. That was liquidated. People who ran it were not elected by the faculty, but they were now appointed. A number of professors were dismissed, primarily because of their advanced age, poor qualifications, alcoholism. There was only one, Ivan Snevensky, who taught philosophy, was dismissed for ideological reasons. Only one. That probably was not enough. We know what the left does in the university. We know what I've been through in the university. What made Magnitsky particularly dangerous is that he knew both left and the right by both personal and intellectual experience. He had one goal here, to recreate the universities and the entire public education system in Russia in such a way as to prevent them to become from becoming centers of leftist activism, which is certainly a reasonable goal. He also noted that a lot of the Western Enlightenment style teaching was kind of just brought and imposed without any regard as to the different cultures. And he said this, he said, we borrowed education from foreign lands without adapting it to our own situation, without Russifying it. And moreover, the most unfavorable moment, the 17th and only 18th centuries, that is, during its dangerous contagion, we transplanted the poisonous plant into our cold area where it does harm slowly because it grows poorly. The point is, bringing education into line with the national characteristics of the empire. Being a nationalist, he said, Russia has a special character. Consequently, its education must be taken account of these very specific and distinctive properties, which is certainly reasonable. In other words, these professors, these administrators, had no real connection to Russia. They were promoting incompetent people solely based on their ideology or nepotism or something like that. But he wanted to create a whole new approach to education here, a Christian one, and replacing the materialism that arose in the influence, according to him, of paganism and unbelief. This is an era, 1819, 1820, this was just the gestation of the very early Jewish terrorist groups. They didn't exist at the time, but they were just getting formed. It's going to take a while. The worst of it came after the reforms of Alexander II. But some of these cells were just taking form, of course, although in this mostly in elite circles. The Decembrists are an obvious example. He also condemned the notion, as I've written whole papers on this, that the concept of science being morally neutral is a myth. It's really a cover story. He debated professors there. They claimed that there were no moral or legal presuppositions in the scientific method. But in his debate with them in 1823, and he's not talking necessarily about logical connection, but actually how it was done in practice. He said, your study doesn't take revelation into account. It's taught in respect to the entire human race without any distinctions. It doesn't assume the fall of man, which is an enormous concern, since it just assumes that everyone's going to be honest. It doesn't assume that royal power comes from God. And of course, there's a sexual element to this that he saw on campus because these revolutionaries were talking about marriage as a contract, just like society was a contract. These were some early forms of nihilism, or what we would call positivism today. Scientific method, the way it was understood, was leading to, and these were mostly Gentiles here, leading towards the revolution that was going to explode over the next 30, 40 years, and the terrorism that came, eventually that murdered Tsar Alexander II. He had detailed instructions to the director of the Kazan University in 1820. And he said, here's the point of education. Men need to be taught to be faithful sons of the Orthodox Church, loyal subjects of the sovereign, good and useful citizens of the fatherland. And that comes before anything else that they might specialize in at the university. Students were permitted for the first time. You know, there were chapels that were erected on campus. They were rewarded for, you know, mercy, you know, almsgiving, visiting the sick and stuff like that. Students showing Christian virtues were encouraged. But of course, today, you know, they're taught utter debauchery, which I personally partook in many, many, many years ago at the University of Hartford. I was a straight A student, but I was a partier. But I bet you I was tame compared to what's happening today. And he was very thorough about this. He wanted lecture notes. He wanted students' notebooks. Well, again, absolutely no different than what's happening today. I had to deal with that. So for them to pretend to be outraged is ridiculous. Also, be careful the concept of the word free thought or free thinking. That just means liberalism. Free thinking was their propaganda word. There's nothing free about it. I don't know how you could talk about freedom if you're a materialist. But he refused to permit anything that would give ammunition to those who would destroy the church and the monarchy. And it makes even more sense to realize what Russia had just gone through. The French Revolution ultimately led, through many, many steps, to the invasion of the country by Napoleon. Students had to be watched. Now, he didn't realize how prophetic he was being. Remember, when the Polish state was partitioned between Austria, Russia, and Prussia, very late 18th century, Russia took a huge chunk of territory with millions of Jews. The worst thing that could have ever happened to them. They ended up being absolutely nothing but a albatross around the neck of that country, which is what we're dealing with in the our study of 200 years together. And you know, the legal profession, of course, the banking, merchants, and universities. These were their targets. Now, Magnitsky doesn't really talk about that very much. This was just getting started. But he could see things. In terms of political philosophy, for example, the Old Testament, Plato and Aristotle, and when you deal with modernism, Machiavelli and Hobbes, they are never to be advocated. You do not advocate this kind of thing. You don't editorialize. And stress has to be put on royal rule, descending from God, and that order is established as an expression of the will of the Most High. That's his quote It was either that or 1789. And the rest of Russian history will bear this out. Now, you're trying to Christianize the student body, which seems kind of naive, but it's only because of my own experience. Despite the war, Russia was rebuilding and had a very strong sense of nationalism here. So he wasn't, you know, today, you know, encouraging students to pray and go to church. It seems ridiculous, but in 1820, it was not. But let me give you an example. Let me quote him here. All these translations are mine, by the way, as bad as they probably are. Give me an example of what he meant by this. He says, "The general feeling of Christianity is love. And what do we see in the disciples of Jesus? How do we recognize them? Precisely and solely by the boundless, all-embracing love, which every day before our eyes produces so many miracles of self-denial. Love of God, love for the Tsar, love for one's neighbor, always ready to pour out itself in benefactions and services and consolation. Love for one's very enemies doesn't consist in forgetting offenses. Love isn't the same as oblivion, but in constant readiness to forgive with all one's heart. It is love for good order, and with an aversion to self-will, the love for the law that protects this order, and love for the executors of those laws. Love could be found in the state, families, for all men, educated and savage, ready to die for their salvation. Love without exception and limits. All Enlightenment teachings, being on the contrary, are negative and destructive. They have a common principle, the domination of man. And as soon as man recognizes himself as his own sovereign, then he is already a rebel against God and against all authority established by God. A rebel can only hate. Therefore, the general feeling generated by rationalist teachings is hatred. Who will doubt it? Remembering the reign of philosophy, the reign of rationalism under the guise of various revolutions. Who will doubt it? Looking at what it's been doing in the last 40 years, even recently, all around us. What a frenzy of the most bestial passions. What a refinement of malice, unheard of crimes. Napoleon, a few years earlier, had just invaded Russia. And he, of course, was a direct product of the revolution. I mean, how could that ever be tolerated in Russian universities at the time? Now, in Western universities, for the last 100 years at least, Darwinism and materialism, this was the norm. It has to be, you know, it's taken for granted. Of course, he says back then, he's talking about physics, natural history, astronomy. They're obligated, according to him, to point out the wisdom of God and the limitations of our senses and instruments for the knowledge of the wonders that constantly surround us. In other words, he's trying to clip their ego, which is very hard to do. He also wants to emphasize the vast kingdom of nature is only a weak imprint of that higher order to which after a short life we are destined to. And there certainly is absolutely nothing scientific, non-scientific about any of this. This is quite reasonable. I mentioned the fall of man, the concept that ego, not the love of truth, is what's happening here. And that certainly is, then and now. Church fathers, the gospel, when it comes to literature and political thought. And don't forget, he says, the beauties of the Slavic language, the great works of Lomonosov, Gabriel Dzhovin, Ivan Bogdanovich. In order to reject everything that is introduced into the language by arbitrariness and boldness as non-classical and unworthy of imitation. In the ancient world, the focus should be on St. John Chrysostom, Gregory of Nazianzus, Basil, Athanasius the Great. This should be the focus, in those fields that are connected to it. That these have to be the core, not the ego of the scientific establishment or the money that comes in to pay them. Now, he justified what he did here many years later, and he said the following. The success of the Illuminati is especially encouraged by the fact that these conspirators act according to a firm, age-old plan and completely systematically, while those who oppose them come out in fits and starts and without a plan. How else can you explain that in Vienna and Italy and Berlin, Russia, for more than half a century, the most important matter for all religious, for all governments, for all peoples, the thread which constantly falls into our hands everywhere, remains uninvestigated. ending only in local reprisals or subscriptions about leaving such a society, which not only violation of the given subscription, but also perjury and contempt for all social and family duties and life itself, is the basic dogma. Now, I know that's my awful translation here. But what it comes down to is that what I'm doing, and I'm, you know, speaking as him, what I'm doing at Kazan, what I want to do for all of Russia, is to imitate the left, to imitate the Jews, which is not a terrible thing. They have a firm sense of ideology, a strong focus. Still, though, the left is, has always been, a movement of the elite. But precisely those, their children heading towards university education. Ultimately, it comes down to the wealthy seeking to manipulate their markets, making the population into a mass, a group without any identity or purpose. Because of its elite origin, they have the power not only to finance these movements, but also being able to convince people that the people, or some other abstraction, is being served here. They're the ones who are actually doing it. Those who understood the French Revolution understood what was going on. The revolution was to enshrine an arrogant oligarchy in power by force. Concerning their takeover of Britain, he says this: in London, the Illuminati of another kind did not lose time, for in the midst of the Capital University was recently established, and which by its statutes, Christian teaching was excluded under the pretext that it would not hinder people of all faiths, Jews, idolaters, worshippers of fire, the Dalai Lama, from studying science regardless of their faith. A brief, and in view of the haste of this work, too superficial review of the state of the world conspiracy shows sufficiently how great the danger is, how far-sighted the guard is, and how the defense must be correctly positioned to protect that one empire which by its great destiny on earth is probably destined to be an indestructible stronghold, at the foot of which the stormy stream must disappear. He already realizes Russia's mission. People were talking like this in, you know, the 1860s and 70s. He was talking about this in 1819 and 1820. Being able to see this in this era is extraordinary. But remember, he was an ambassador to revolutionary France. He saw it firsthand. He was a former Mason, friend of Speransky. He knew the Bible Society that we've talked about elsewhere was a cover for a much deeper agenda. Because ecumenism is meant to lead to atheism. Because if all religions are equal, then none have any claim to truth. And what are the results? And he says this: from the opposite feelings born of these two opposite doctrines, Christian and rationalist, come two kinds of sacrifices: the sacrifice of oneself to another, the sacrifice of love, and the sacrifice of others to themselves, the sacrifice of hatred. This hatred has different degrees. It is not so fierce where some tradition, albeit perverted, remains about the divinity, but there may still be a limit. There is still recognized certain duties. Thus, paganism sacrificed a private person by a man's society, but in the rationalistic religion, the whole society is sacrificed to the private individual. And he was aware that the left was willing to slaughter huge numbers of people to make their utopia come true. In the historical field, the professors there were obligated first to trace the role of Christianity in the church, you know, where it was, you know, appropriate, and that our fatherland, Russia, had a central role in what came later. The studies and behavior of the students were to be orthodox. History professors had to expand on the glory of the fatherland, especially the royal house, remarkable events of bringing unity out of chaos, the monarchs did. Truth is that so many of the liberal professors had no right to be there, and they were promoted as they are today, solely due to ideological conformity. He wanted to replace the study of Roman law with Byzantine law, specifically the Kormchaya Kniga, or the Pilate's Book, the digest of canons translated by St. Cyril Methodius. That was meant to be the source of the study. He even wanted to create a constitution department dealing with the English, French, and Polish variations, exposing constitutionalism as a fraud that it was. 1823, he confronted Galitzin, and he said, "The natural sciences, in the positivist way, deal sacrilegious blows to the throne of the czars, the authorities, and the sacrament of the marital union." You know, this is the second time he's brought up, there is no question that positivism had a connection to the sexual revolution. Because if that's all marriage is a simple contract, then anything goes. This was the passions that was being released. It was too hard being Orthodox or being Catholic. Now, there's no real logical, doesn't entail that in terms of behavior, but in practical terms, all these revolutionaries had the same point of view. Marriage ultimately was going to be abolished by completely demoting it. Then he said, materialism, naturalism, that's nothing other than real illuminism. So the result is that first, wherever this is promoted, he said, at first faith wavered and disappeared, then opinions became agitated, the way of thinking changed only by a change in meaning and substitution of words, and from this imperceptible and, as it were, literary undermining, the altar of Christ and the thousand-year-old throne of ancient sovereigns were destroyed. And this is something that listeners of mine should know extremely well. The manipulation of language. But of course, he turned out to be entirely correct. He's talking about the lodges. In his letter to Tsar Nicholas I, he says, "They've composed a whole special dialect of their own, which, expressing their concepts with perfect precision, brings out another side which, like counterfeit coin, deceives by its appearance the inexperience of well-intentioned people. Because of this unanimous recognition of its genuine, respectable persons, they clearly see the forgery. They don't dare go against the general opinion. The trumpet which the Illuminati would immediately proclaim, and ignoramuses, restless people, fanatic, conspiracy theorists. For example, the generally accepted axiom, one must consider decrees and laws with the spirit of their times. Well, that seems very innocent, yet it contains within itself the passing word of the Illuminati, as well as the expression, one must spread the kingdom of reason, patronize freedom of conscience, exterminate and ridicule fanaticism, religious fanaticism, and have a liberal way of thinking. These words, under the guise of expressions known to all, having a meaning known to all, constitute a universal language, which the Illuminati use in order to speak safely among themselves, from one end of the world to the other, so that European peoples, having listened to it, inadvertently memorize and repeat their dogmas, thus forming, mechanically so to speak, a common opinion of their meaning." He is writing, you know, I've been talking about this now for 20 years, how important the manipulation of language is. The radical, it's not sudden, but the radical alteration in the use of words and slogans. We've been through this 1,000 times since I've been doing this. They don't stand for freedom of conscience. When they use that phrase, they know what they mean. Separation of church and state. Well, Lenin created that phrase, and he did it to destroy the church. He didn't care about whether they should be separated. He wanted it destroyed. But everyone who uses that phrase wants it destroyed. That's why it was coined in the first place. So there's two levels of meaning. There's levels for the ordinary person, the exoteria, and the esoteria. The esoteric, which is understood by initiates and initiates only, who rarely talk about their full agenda in public. And this is what many of us, I think E. Michael Jones was the first one to use the phrase, the reformatting of the default settings of European peoples. Well, I am already over an hour and 5 minutes. This is going to have to be a two-part series, which I did not expect. So I'm going to end this here, and I'm going to continue with this and the situation of political theory, universities, and revolution in the first half of the 19th century next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.